We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
You know, usually those sound clips, one or two of them might be included in a discussion that follows. But every one of those subjects and topics comes up in what we're going to be talking about today on Keeping Democracy Alive. It's quite a new book. And I'll tell you, growing up in the 50s and 60s in America, torture was simply unthinkable. It was one of the most basic things which separate America from the bad guys like the Germans or the Russians. Fairness and justice were an essential part of our exceptional identity. No more. They call it enhanced interrogation, but it's torture. And America's fighting forces were victorious in the Second World War in part because we abided by the rules of engagement, international agreements. Only the real bad guys would even consider violating those agreements. Now the person directing the killing can be thousands of miles away through the use of drones. And drone attacks, torture, they're part of the new military-industrial complex, and they're going on more and more. And this dramatic change in American military policy and tactics, how has drone warfare and torture affected our success on the battlefield? How well does torture work? How does it affect those good Americans who find themselves carrying out the torture? And what about the chilling prospect of private corporations getting into the business themselves? Well, our guests today on Keeping Democracy Alive are the two co-authors of a new novel called Broken! Exclamation point. They're Michael Kearns and Ronald Solomon. Gentlemen, are you with us?
Yes, Michael Kearns here.
Oh, good. Well, we'll start up. Michael Kearns is a retired Air Force intelligence officer and former master survival evasion resistance escape instructor. who used enhanced interrogation techniques, torture, against hundreds of American troops in order to teach them how to survive enemy tortures. And Solomon has an extensive background as a television executive producer, head writer, and show creator. So he had a lot of the color, I suspect, in this. He's deeply concerned about the negative effects of, quote, our financial elitists and their government lapdogs on our citizenry. His experience helped give the book their first novel its genuinely exciting cinematic feeling. I can attest to that, which its action and intensity. I would be surprised if Broken does not become a motion picture. Kearns and Solomon are donating 20% of the net profits of sales of the book Broken to Veterans for Peace. Well, again, thanks for being with us. This is powerful stuff. What was your purpose in creating this book?
Well, this is Michael Kearns. For me, creating the book is somewhat of a catharsis for me.
I'll bet.
All of this brought on some pretty bad post-traumatic stress when I realized that that's what our government was doing, was taking the things that we knew were illegal, and Bruce Jessen and Jim Mitchell, they made $81 million creating the torture program for Bush and Cheney, and that was just beyond anything I could believe.
Yeah.
This book with Ron really helped me get over the reality of it, and I'm hoping it'll be a national discussion, hopefully.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who are very, very much affected by it, no doubt about it. Who is the target audience? Who are you trying to reach? Who do you think will pick it up?
Ron.
Go Go ahead.
You know, I think that the target audience is, by and large, people who don't understand the full scope and the full extent of what we did. We as a country.
Right.
And by creating a work of fiction that has a very high intensity level of action and adventure, you know, kind of in a Clancy-esque way, we're hoping that these people will read the book and love the book, but through reading it, we'll start to question some of the things. And yeah, it actually has happened. You know, they're emailing us on our Facebook page, and they're saying, hey, did this stuff really happen? And so they're starting to twist their thinking around a little bit. You know, we don't want to preach to the choir, so to speak.
Mm. But hopefully those who have been through it, and there's a lot of people who have been through it, can, you know, there's a feel some kinship there and get the word out. And I wanted to ask, how much of Michael Kearns is Captain Charles Ponce, also known as Chauncey? I get the sense a lot of these people were real people that you knew that may have been blended into the character. How many Chaunceys may be among our veterans?
Michael, do you want to handle that?
Sure. I suspect that it's good for your audience to know that the SEER program, up until we started hearing about it most recently, just in the last 8 to 10 years, was fairly confidential. Most people that went through SEER training did not choose to talk about it because it's one of those things, the more that an enemy or the more that it's known in common language across the world, the more that other organizations that may be the antithesis of what we're using it against, but potentially the enemy could get to know more about you, and it would make it easier for someone to be interrogated in a way that they would not want to be interrogated.
Yeah, and again, SEER is survival, evasion, resistance, escape, which Michael Kearns, you taught people. I can't imagine what that experience was like. It was, I mean, were you torturing American soldiers?
Well, we certainly used a lot of the techniques that you or your audience may have read. Those 12 enhanced interrogation techniques were the foundation of the resistance to interrogation portion of SEER. SEER is much bigger than just resistance to interrogation. I actually started in my SEER training doing evasion and escape training, training pilots and navigators and other crew members how to actually evade the enemy if they were shot down, and if they were captured and put in a prisoner of war camp, mm-hmm. how then to potentially escape.
Well, that's useful stuff, though, isn't it? I mean, you want people to be able to escape. So isn't this a good and worthy program, the SEER program?
Well, there's several people that I know personally that have evaded, escaped, had resisted interrogation by a hostile enemy, and to a person, they all thank me for the training. They thank the SEER program for being there. Think of Scott O'Grady, who was shot down in Bosnia. He says that the SEER evasion and escape maps that he used that were very uniquely made for just that purpose helped save his life.
Mm-hmm. I guess the concern is it could get out of hand. I mean, it sounds like the SEER program was very focused on helping, you know, our guys resist torture and be able to escape. But there's a lot of picture painting in this book about how all that stuff can get out of control. And this book, called Broken, vividly paints a picture of, it seems like, a very near future world, either protected by drones or infested with drones, depending on how you look at it. Drones, of course, have been used often in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, and who knows how many other places. Your book has them flying in very large, organized packs, little things, but in big packs. And the reality here now today is that local law enforcement across the country has been getting a lot of military equipment, probably drones as well. And they're more effective, cheaper surveillance. And just reading from a recent bit of news, FBI Director James Comey admitted in testimony recently before the House Judiciary Committee that the agency conducted surveillance flights over mass protests against police brutality in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland over the past year at the request of local police departments. Comey's remarks confirmed an earlier Associated Press report revealing the FBI's extensive use of secret flyovers throughout the country. The hearing itself mislabeled as being dedicated to the oversight of the FBI was a further indication of the ability of government agencies like the FBI to carry out illegal mass surveillance against the American population with impunity. And you write, quote, American citizens are being digitally tagged and tracked like cattle. What are the concerns with the ever-growing surveillance state and its ever-widening acceptance? Throw it to either one of you.
Well, you have, with drones, what you have for the first time in history is a technology, a very low-cost technology that nobody ever anticipated. The drone manufacturers are complaining, and they're pushing back, and they're saying that you can't blame the technology for the privacy concerns because a drone in and of itself doesn't have a camera. But what this does is it provides a low-cost, very simple system through which you can attach all kinds of forms of surveillance. And the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Patrol, they have predators at our southern and northern borders. They say it's for drug trafficking, but they're looking at ranchers and they're looking over cities. They have these cameras that can take in an entire city and hover for years above us, and they are in fact doing that. Mm. You have local law enforcement that is getting. They're getting small drones. They're called quadcopters or octocopters, and they're 4 or 8 blades. And they have these very advanced cameras on them that, with license plate readers that they can do from 400 feet above, 1,000 feet above. They can follow a car. They do retinal scans, facial recognition software in these cameras. And the drones are so inexpensive, relatively speaking. It used to they'd have to have a helicopter or they'd have to have a stakeout. And now they can literally stalk us anywhere we are. And this is true. This is not an alarmist mentality.
Not at all. Not at all. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here on Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guests today are Michael Kearns and Ronald Solomon, co-authors of the brand new book, Broken, which is pretty intense, I have to say. And you cite and fully quote the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. And you say, to many, they were the most important part of the Bill of Rights. To others, they were simply an unfortunate obstacle to keeping people safe. I wonder if you could say more about that.
You know, for most people, they're giving away their privacy, just wholesale. They're just giving it up on Facebook. They're giving it up on LinkedIn. You know, Google records when you say, you know, hey, Google, and then you ask a question. Google is recording your voice and your requests, and they're just cataloging it, and you know what the NSA is doing. So a lot of it is voluntary, that we're giving away our freedom. And when that happens, that's okay because we're stepping into something knowingly. But the government, the overreach from the Patriot Act, and the marketing companies, the overreach from the Internet, what they're doing is that they are just taking our data and they are profiling us. And then they're selling the data in the case of marketing companies so that we get advertised that we don't want. Mm-hmm. They're also knowing what books we're reading and they're putting in us, they're profiling us. So the danger is very real that some McCarthy could come along one day and utilize all this data that was never before accessible. The NSA's, Michael, how big is the NSA's place in Utah?
They say it's about 9 petabytes of information.
9 petabytes?
So they want to know everything about us under the guise of keeping us safe.
Right.
And that's just not the way the Constitution was written. The Fourth Amendment safeguards our privacy, says we have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Generally, that's within the four walls of our home. But now with these drones and with all the sophisticated cameras and all of the online information that they're collecting about us, they've permeated into our homes.
Yeah, it really, it's a nightmarish picture that is painted quite vividly in this book, Broken. And, you know, with drones are everywhere. They're very common now. They're getting more and more common. And with technological improvements, drones may soon, are concerned about, drones may soon recognize feelings from people's subtle actions. And I know that drones in places like Afghanistan and Yemen and things like that have recognized certain actions as being indicative of terrorist action, and oftentimes it's not. I mean, a lot of wedding parties have been, you know, just destroyed because it kind of looks like the profile of terrorists. So drones may soon actually be able to recognize feelings from people's subtle action. Do you think people in the near future may become afraid to think wrong thoughts?
Well, certainly,
yes, it's, you know, some people call that the chilling effect.
Yeah.
And so if you think you're being watched, and just human behavior to behave properly, right? It starts with children, and we put these little cameras around, and if the kid knows he's being watched, he's going to fly right. That's why they have centralized guard towers in prisons, because if the prisoners believe they're being watched at all times, then they're going to behave properly.
Wow.
But to what you were saying, there's a part of the book, we use torture in the book,
yes,
in every possible situation that you can think of, going all the way back to techniques used during the Spanish Inquisition by Torquemada, to the techniques that Michael and Sear used, to what the CIA used at Gitmo, but also pushing its future into an AI, into artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And that's drones, right? They're just robots. And you just mentioned that you can see a future. Well, let me tell you, the future is here. There's something, a screening system called Avatar, which is short for Automated Virtual Agent for Truth Assessments in Real Time. And they're kiosks, okay? And they're being installed in airports, and they're being installed at the border with Mexico, where when you go to it, instead of having a border guard interview you to cross over, it's this kiosk that is, an avatar is on the kiosk, speaking to you and asking you, you know, do you have anything to declare, et cetera, and so forth, all the questions. But at the same time, it's measuring your pupil dilation.
Mm.
It's measuring your voice modulation, in some cases, your blood pressure. And it is assessing whether or not you are being truthful or not. And if it determines you're not being truthful, then you are then going to be pulled over and subjected to further search and interrogation by the Customs and Border Patrols of the countries where it's being used. Happening now.
Wow. That certainly is chilling. It just seems so beyond 1984-ish. Tell us about a couple of things in the book. Panopticon and MAID, M-A-I-D. Tell us what those are.
Well, the MAID is a fictional interrogation device that we created that uses sophisticated algorithms and everything that I just explained, plus more in terms of what that avatar does, and really pushes it to the extreme to be self-aware and make the determinations on its own as to whether or not a person is being truthful. And if it determines the person is not being truthful, it then assesses their personality types based on criteria that, Michael, really, you could speak to better, KU Bark, all of the interrogation manuals, something we call the Cheney algorithm.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't believe you, then it can meet out enhanced interrogation techniques and find the ones that are best suited to you. In other words, you know, some of the things that Michael taught me was that you're not going to use a stress position on everybody. You're only going to use it on a certain personality type that would respond to that type of interrogation technique.
Hmm.
Right, Michael?
Yeah, and certainly some of the things that we use in the interrogation techniques, we would assess the person before we ever even touch them. We may watch them, how they interact with their friends. We would have had collection on them over their communications for some time before they're selected. In an ideal interrogation, we would know all these things about someone before we started going into their mind, so to speak, to figure out the truth from the falsehood.
Hmm. Boy, that is quite the chilling picture of Big Brother. What about
right? But from a business perspective, that's inefficient. So the book takes the position that they want to get rid of these inefficiencies. Costs too much money. It hurts too many people. In terms of the good guys, they don't really care so much about the bad guys, so to speak. So they want to automate this in order to spare the torturers, and they want to be able to do this and access every database available so they can just do these auto assessments. They can get rid of translators so they can just completely clean it out and make it a very streamlined loop of determining guilt and meeting out the interrogation techniques that are required.
Yeah, and the power of corporations is a very, very big deal, sort of blending, overlapping with the military and corporations in this book. Is that where Panopticon comes in?
No, Panopticon is actually a real thing. Jeremy Bentham was an architect, and he designed the Panopticon was a concept for a prison. And it was a centralized guard tower with a 360-degree view, one-way mirror, one-way glass. And the courtyard of all the prisoners were in a circular cell, a circular building around the centralized guard tower with all of the cells facing the middle and open so that whoever was in the guard tower could see every prisoner at every moment, and the prisoners would never know if they were watched or if they were not watched. It became an instrument, a concept for society, that the Panopticon is a great way of getting citizens to behave the way you want them, because if they never know if they're being watched, the assumption is that they're always being watched, and if you're always being watched, you're always going to be behaving properly.
Hmm.
So the drone with the cameras really does represent the Panopticon.
Mm-hmm.
We will very soon, some cities it's already happening now, we are always going to be watched. And the goal would be, obviously, to control us. For marketers, obviously, to sell to us, but from the government perspective, it's a great way to keep the citizens, straight, flying right. And it's an awful concept. So in the book, Panopticon is a conspiracy that the drone manufacturers, who've now lost all this wonderful revenue for their drones overseas because the wars are winding down, they don't want to give up the money. So they turn it on to the United States.
It's funny, but it's horrifying, and it's obviously very real. So this book covers a lot of drones and there's a lot of action in the book. Just leave it at that. Take my word for it. And I think it's safe to assume that the vast majority of Americans who join our military services do so out of a sincere love of country and a dedication to fighting the bad guys. That's why they go in. And early on in the book, you talk about people in Afghanistan, including young character Armagon, I hope I pronounced that right, who is to play an important role in the macabre tale. The easy picture for most to see is Taliban and Al-Qaeda terrorists filling up the region, just real bad guys everywhere. Or as you write, evil fanatics trying to kill our troops and destroy America's way of life. But as you also write, even with the harsh desert and constant threat of death around them, the tribe celebrated life. I want to repeat that. Even with the harsh desert and constant threat of death around them, the tribe celebrated life. Contrast to that, you guys also describe the emptiness of super rich, power hungry corporate giants, many of whom get rich by creating these most effective killing machines, the drones. Talk about the contrasting experiences of life, the emptiness, the fullness, and you paint quite a picture of both those experiences of life.
Michael? I think certainly the idea of life and celebration is something attuned to most cultures. Everyone loves to share their time with each other and their families. And unfortunately, as we find in warfare today, and given my background, I was a targeting officer in the early 90s, I was a scientist. My degree is from the University of Maryland in remote sensing and satellite imaging. And some of the things we were working on in the 1980s have brought the fruit to bear, so to speak. And we have sensors now that can detect a person running across an open field. And if that field is one of these authorized free fire zones, then the sensors all the way to the shooters, the Hellfire missiles, can be something which would only take a few moments. But today we have one, almost an automaton kind of system that can go out, assess, and then bring in weaponry against people. And unfortunately, in a culture, if you're trying to celebrate life, having those foreboding things over your head that no one are watching you 7x24, that doesn't allow much for celebration, does it?
And then there's the, how full is the life of the, you know, super rich, obsessively power hungry corporate giants who are making money from this stuff? You know, the contrast in the life, you know, where you're part of a tribe, you know who you are and you celebrate life, compared to, you know, the paranoia, the unbelievable, you know, security measures that these guys figure they have to take. It's quite a contrast. How common is what happened to Armaghan's people in Afghanistan? Tragic and mistaken attacks, as you call them. How are such things perceived in Afghanistan? And what does that do to the goal of winning any kind of victory for American interests in Afghanistan, those tragic and mistaken attacks? And it had some significant effects on your character, Armaghan.
Right.
Go ahead, Michael.
Somebody go.
No, I was going to say we created Armaghan as sort of a one of the faces, because, you know, we've read over the years how drone attacks have mistakenly destroyed weddings or funerals,
yes,
lifestyle events.
Yes.
You know, the ACLU and EFF, they've applied under the Freedom of Information Act to get more specific information about the wrong, you know, the civilian casualties that the drones have inflicted in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen, even in Iraq. And we don't get a lot of it. And then when we do get it, it's very sketchy. It's very black and white. And so to take a character whose life was affected so intensely by one of those incidents, we felt was a very interesting way to go and see what happened to this person's life.
Right.
What were they like? How did they feel after their life had been taken away? And then, you know, the United States justified it in the name of freedom.
And Armaghan goes on to an interesting future. I'll just leave it at that. Tell us about your concerns about the partnering of the surveillance state with the corporate elite. Those two coming together and working together so swell.
Well, ultimate control controls ultimately. Certainly that's what surveillance states want. They want to have their hand on the pulse, not just of what is happening, but what is future crime, which I find to be kind of crazy. That if that's what the NSA's objective was, by collecting everything, is to do forensics, is to find a piece of information on someone who may be doing criminal activity and then be able to actually look into history to find maybe there's some other friends or other organizations this person is associated with that then could be used against them as a future crime.
And you have them working together with the corporate elite, that, you know, because they love information. I mean, that's what all these, so many things you see advertised, you know, about finding out what service people are good in your neighborhood is really just about collecting information about you to target and sell you more stuff. I find that a bit chilling as well. And to combine those two, the surveillance state with the corporate interests, you know,
there shouldn't be any surprise about that, how much we've privatized. You know, our intelligence is privatized to private corporations. Even the meals in the military are privatized. You've got the military doing consulting with the entertainment industry and the video game industry so that they can essentially use movies and video games as recruitment tools to make it look cool. Drone operators, the drone controls are actually patterned on a PlayStation controller. So that kids are growing up using the controls for drones. This is not new. This has been happening ever since Eisenhower warned us against the military-industrial complex, and it's just so entrenched in our society at this point.
Yeah, it is, and you talk about Eisenhower's warning back in 1961. I came across a quote from President Kennedy, who of course came into the White House right after President Eisenhower. He talked about secrecy. He said, this is a quote from President Kennedy, "The very word secrecy is repugnant in an open and free society. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today," and again, this is 1961, "there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment that I do not intend to permit to the extent that it is in my control. And no official in my administration, whether it's rank or high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know." Secrecy, that's the end of his quote. Secrecy is essential to power in this book, is it not?
And it's a secrecy about things that a lot of Americans are giving up almost freely. If you look at Facebook and other kinds of web-based presence, that people do this as if it's some kind of social network that's just out there and free, although we're giving our own freedoms up by using it.
Yeah, we really are. And what is this? We talked a little bit about early on the psychologists with whom you worked, Michael, making big bucks from some of these enhanced interrogation programs. Tell us about that, if you would, please.
Well, I had left the Special Survival Training Program in 1991, so my term of working out there was approximately 3.5 years, and I was completely shocked when I found out in about 2007 that it was the Air Force that did these enhanced interrogation technique programs, and it was also my two psychologists that I worked with, Jim Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. And that's the shocking thing for me is when I initially read Jim Risen's book, A State of War, it mentioned in there that the SEER program was what was reverse engineered, and it said it was the Army. I almost felt relieved that it was the Army initially. I couldn't believe my own guys did such a thing, but once the Senate report came out of who was doing what within the torture program, I ended up reading names of people I worked with and some who I actually supervised, which is the weirdest thing, that I see friends of mine, and we did not do torture. We did training. So I think there's a thing that the listeners must understand is that the things that we do in SEER program, survival, evasion, resistance to interrogation and escape, we do not torture people. We push them to a point of torture, but the point is not to break a person when you're training someone. The point is, if they're having a hard time resisting or doing something that's a positive learning environment issue, that if they start to falter a little bit, we actually take them out of the game, and we give them almost Socratic-styled questions.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to make sure that the individual students, although they have a small amount of time, that they will remember the significant emotional experiences within the SEER program. So that will help them the next time if they actually are captured by an enemy, that they've already experienced being captured by an enemy to some extent.
Mm-hmm. So forewarned is forearmed. And torture has been used, enhanced interrogation. A lot of times, thank you, Dick Cheney. How well does it work? Just as a, you know, as a military tactic, aside from any moral questions, how well does it work in winning any of these battles. What do you think?
Well, I think it certainly all comes from history. It comes from the Civil War time when Lieber's Code was designed, and it was the North wanted to make sure that in the aftermath of a Civil War, that we actually treated people during war humanely.
Yeah.
I don't know if many people who are your listeners understand that during World War II, the Germans being held in America were treated very well. They right. had their own farm camps. They did road work and such. And many of the POW camps were in the United States for the Germans that were captured. Actually turned out to be small towns later. The Germans enjoyed staying in the United States as a prisoner of war so well that they actually re-emigrated after the war was over. Now, it was quite a different thing. The Japanese part of the war, the Japanese did not really take hostages, and they treated the Americans very brutally.
Yes, they did.
Remember, they did believe that Tojo there was, to them, their god.
Right.
And they thought they were fighting with full justification of God. Hmm. And I think that's something that really helps to distort what we think of as war when one party thinks that they are actually fighting for God, that they don't have to have any, like the Lieber's Code or the Code of Conduct or the Convention Against Torture, which is now to help so that if one warring party is enacting war against another warring party, that they do it civilly, with chivalry. And I think that's the part that's missing today. We are, especially the United States is looking at the war as against terrorists. And as George Bush said, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists.
Right.
That's a scary thought.
Yeah, reality is often scarier than fiction. And this book is kind of a combination of both. The book is called Broken, and we are talking to its authors today, Michael Kirsch and Ronald Solomon. And one of the intriguing aspects of this book, and we got in on it a little bit there, you know, the idea of sovereignty. The Japanese owed their sovereign was their emperor. And here, you know, traditionally, the United States has been the sovereignty for which we fight. But the transference of feelings of sovereignty from country to corporation, now that's something interesting. I don't know if you could talk about how that comes across in the book and, you know, the profitability of drones and torture and corporations becoming the new sovereign.
The whole sovereign concept really came from during the Spanish Inquisition with Torquemada, who was the Grand Inquisitor. What they were doing was they were torturing people to admit a change in sovereign, to admit they were infidels, and it all had to do with religion. And like you were saying, Bert, now it's changed, and we mentioned in the book that the sovereign has gone from religion to a government, so being a nationalist, being an American citizen, to now really having a patriotism of some sort to your employer, to the corporation for which you work, and money, capitalism. So capitalism, to many people, has supplanted government and religion.
Yes.
So that's what they're beholden to. And so it's a soulless, it's immoral. And if that is your sovereign, then who are you as a person? And what are you beholden to, really, in any kind of a meaningful way?
Yeah, that's pretty.
It's more of a comment on something that, you know, we see happening in our world that's troublesome.
Indeed. Let me read a few lines from the book. In the kindest sense, Chauncey's conclusion, and Chauncey is one of the main characters, was that the country was caught up with fear and lost its way. America had been injured and, like a wounded animal, had emerged from the darkness worse than the beast it despised and feared. Talk about the role you see fear playing in American politics and everyday reality. What is this fear used since 9/11? What has it done to us?
Well, certainly 9/11 was a very fearful day. To imagine foreign nationals being able to actually touch the heart of America. And there's a a lot of psychologists and philosophers that believe that once you get a country or a nation state to start worrying, to have fear, then the more the nation state will trust in whatever governance is in place. And I think that's also a means of deception.
Yeah, manipulating fear. Of course, when President Roosevelt talked about the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, I think he knew exactly what he was talking about, the manipulation of fear. And certainly Bush and Cheney were masters at that. And of course, PTSD is a big, big problem. And, you know, how our veterans have been treated, big problem. And PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and how veterans deal with it or don't deal with it plays an important role in the book. The title, of course, is Broken. And again, from a different part of the book, you think that anyone, including me, who admits they got PTSD or some other bull something, mind something from what they did is a fairy. That's why nobody talks about it, because, you know, if you think you got PTSD, you're considered a fairy. Say more about this problem, please. How pervasive is it that sufferers see PTSD as their own personal character flaw?
Well, certainly people who go in the military think they're supermen, right, or superwomen.
Right.
You go through lots of hard training. You're in a discipline. You're supposed to say, aye, sir, or yes, sir, and give me more work to do, and I'll put it in my backpack, and I'll help my brother and sisters in arms. And a weak person is someone who complains. And I think the issue of PTSD is we're only scraping the surface just a little bit with the way the VA is helping, if you can call it help. Most individuals who leave the service don't get to see the VA very quickly. And then once you put your paperwork into the Veterans Administration, they almost start from zero in analyzing what medical problems one may have, and certainly the psychiatric issues of PTSD may be rooted and may not sprout until years later. There may be other kinds of triggers that might bring one's PTSD to the fore, and certainly it's something that causes families to rip apart. And we're finding, at least in the Veterans Administration, their first way of treating PTSD, typically, and I heard a number of something like 99% of the time, is to give these SSRI drugs, the selective serotonin uptake inhibitor drugs, which actually, after a period of months, cause even more declination in a person's ability to interact socially at a level that would be something like the person was originally. So we have an unfortunate system of looking at military people as being chattel, as being something to be owned and discarded when it has its use-by date.
Hmm. And the book paints quite a picture of people suffering with it and what they do with it. And of course, it's been around forever. They used to call it shell shock in the First World War. And I can't help but think that if you put normal, decent people in incredibly inhuman situations and they witness these horrible things, things that they have perhaps done themselves that otherwise they wouldn't done. You know, if you come out sane from that, that's like sort of an insanity, it seems to me. I mean, how can you not go a little bit nuts from seeing these horrible, horrible, really inhuman things?
Right, and as a nation, how can we not, if we're going to send our soldiers over to do this type of work, then how dare we not have the facilities to take care of them when they come home? You can't have war if you can't deal with the repercussions of it on this side. You know, these men and women, they have to go for private counseling. Their families have to pay. They go broke. They go bankrupt because they can't get into the VA. It's chronic. It's incurable. It's a national disgrace from where I sit. Yeah. You know, I'm not a veteran, but the whole process, this three-year process of writing this book and working with Michael, has made me have such an incredibly high regard for our veterans. And then a horrible disdain for the institutions that are supposed to take care of them when they come back from keeping us safe. It's horrible. So part of the, you know, traumatic brain injury, the military sexual trauma, all part of the PTSD. We talk about that a great deal in the book, and how tragic it is. There's a lot of very specific stories in the book about soldiers and what they've gone through. And most of them are actual factual, based on all research done about what they've gone through. So it's not made up. These are real case studies that we fictionalized, or at least put into fictional people.
And it's a very powerful book. I the words kind of fail me. It's I was reminded at times of some of the spooky feeling I got from watching Apocalypse Now. Just, you know, wow, this is horrible, and it's real, and it's nightmarish. The book is called Broken. Our guest today, my author is Michael Kearns and Ronald Solomon. And one of the things that it seems that since 9/11, aside from, you know, incorporating fear and making fear be so pervasive in our culture, in terms of, you know, making money in so many ways, there's the whole the idea of perpetual war, and drones are, you know, very capable of killing from 1,000 miles away. There was industrialized mechanical killing in the First World War, so the guys didn't directly have to do it themselves. It got even better in the Second World War. Now, the distance, the mechanization, what do these things do to the concept of war and the acceptance of perpetual war, this killing from great distances? Does it make it, how has that affected America and its acceptance of the concept of perpetual war?
Well, we're finding people that are drone pilots and system sensor operators having great PTSD, and they are stationed right here in the United States. You know, they have a building that they're in Nevada, and they're conducting their drone war there, mm-hmm. or at the CIA or other places. But they are the trigger, right? The trigger is what's killing the other people, and they're still here in the United States. So it must be difficult to be a drone operator to spend 12 hours on shift killing people and then going home to your child's birthday party.
God, I can't.
Yeah, one of the characters in the books was a drone, and really we describe what Michael just said about the PTSD that he experienced by this disconnect. And so, you know, how can you abhor war when it's normalized?
Right.
When your day job is to go and operate a drone and shoot supposed terrorists, but then you're really mistakenly shooting innocent people at a wedding, and then go home, have dinner with your family, and then kiss your 5-year-old daughter goodnight, and then go back and repeat that the next day. It's so desensitizing. And then the media doesn't report on it the way that they should. I remember growing up during the Vietnam War and seeing the nightly news with all the coffins coming off of the transport planes coming back from Vietnam with all the dead soldiers. We don't see that anymore. So we're disconnected from war. We don't see the true repercussions. We see it in our economy a bit, but we don't really see it. It's not in our face, and it needs to be in our face. And the less, the more distance that there is between us and the repercussions of war, the longer war will continue, because it doesn't affect us.
Right, right. It's somewhere else. We don't have to see it. We try to avoid boots on the ground. Then somehow it sanitizes the killing, except for the people who are on the ground. And as of now, I'm pretty sure there's virtually no control over the use of drones for domestic spying. Do we need a Domestic Drone Protection Act? Do you think there will be the will to make it happen, or there'll be a lot of resistance to it? How important do you think it is that we get some sort of a Domestic Drone Protection Act?
I think it's essential. You know, unfortunately, I think the horse is out of the barn. The FAA had a mandate to come up with regulations for how drones, civil drones, government drones, modelists, how they use drones. But their mandate was only on the safety side of it, right? It was so that they're not going to fall out of the sky and conk us on the head. Hmm. But nobody, and to me, this is the most important part, are those privacy elements. Nobody is focusing on the privacy elements. We're going to have over 1 million drones sold this Christmas, just the private sector. And people are slapping cameras on them, and they're going over people's backyards, and they're taking pictures of people sunbathing. Who knows what else they're doing? And it's got to be regulated. You know, I know people don't like regulation, but when it comes to my privacy, I don't really care what you think. You know, there needs to be legislation, and there needs to be some real stern talk. People are talking about it. I just don't think it's happening quickly enough, given how widespread drones have become in our world, not only with, like I said, private citizens, but with the police and with the federal government.
And there's, you see these, throughout the book, there's swarms of drones and the various things they can do going over a football game or, you know, various different incidences. And it's so easy to picture. It's really nightmarish stuff. Talk about nightmarish stuff. In your research, Ronald, you did some interesting stuff. You're not a trainer of survival, evasion, resistance, escape. You've been working in TV and writing things like that. Tell us, please, how you got involved and what it was like. It's some interesting stuff. I don't think I would have done it.
Well, you know, you've heard of method acting. This is kind of method writing. So Chauncey Michael happens to be a master skydiver, and so the character Chauncey is as well, and I never skydived. So, you know, had to do that, had to jump out of a plane. I wanted to learn more about drones, so I went to a number of military drone conventions in Washington, D.C. I met with the FAA. I met with... resistance is probably a very light word for what it is, but I tried to get into a number of top secret drone installations around the country and was met with force basically keeping me away. And then I was called multiple times and I would say harassed by the FBI. Who are you? What are you doing? They made me, you know, they weren't satisfied with me just telling them I was an author and writing a book. They really had to know everything. I hung up on them a couple of times, and they didn't like that. When I was trying to learn about the enhanced interrogation, I kind of drew the line. Michael wanted to waterboard me. He still does. But to feel panic and sensory deprivation, I had my son lock me in the trunk of his car and drive around Denver for a while and take some pretty sharp turns, and I tried to keep my bearings and not freak out. So things like it, a lot more, some things I can't even talk about.
Yeah, I'm sure. Wow, that's amazing stuff. The book we're talking about today is Broken. The authors are Michael Kearns and Ronald Solomon. The publisher is Rocky Mountain Press. And I found it interesting that at one point in the book, it's very colorful. And relative to marijuana of Chauncey, you write, it still amazed him that there was a pushback to legalizing this stuff across the entire country. Ah, well, the feds like to control things a bit, he chuckled. How symbolic is this for your perception of government and its corporate partners that, you know, they need to control things a bit?
Michael? Well, with regard to the marijuana, my background being an intelligence officer, and I worked in law enforcement for a while, I had never smoked marijuana until I came to Colorado. Mm-hmm. And I met a doctor of osteopathy, and I have some fairly serious back and head injuries. And my gosh, I found the medical marijuana to be quite helpful, and it was very, very nice to be able to see that Colorado opened that up to even recreational use. And I think the money's garnered off of marijuana has turned Colorado around with regard to.
But this idea of control and not allowing people to feel decent, just this whole control thing, putting it in that context, I think is interesting. You're donating 20% of the net profits of the book to Veterans for Peace. Why? Somebody?
Is that for me?
Either one of you.
From my perspective, it's because of everything, because of the respect that I have for our troops, for our veterans. You know, I mean, first of all, the book from my side of the table, the book would not have been possible without, unfortunately, their pain, without PTSD and military sexual trauma and horrors, the amputees that they went through with war. So I'm not simply going to be someone who exploits them for my own gain. So I feel that I have to give back. And since from my research and obviously what's out in the public eye, the VA is not doing a great job of it.
Right.
I'm personally throwing my support to an organization that I feel is very responsible and sort of is in line. Veterans for Peace. These guys know what they're talking about. They were there. They're not just a bunch of legislators who got out of it because of money or family or position.
They do some good work.
To me, that's my way of giving something back.
Now, there is a growing interest in and demand for reining in the power of the selfish, power-hungry, now in near-total control government. How optimistic are you guys that we can start to rein in some of this power and you know, bring back the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, things like that? How optimistic are you going forward?
Well, certainly it's making things more transparent.
Say that again?
It's making things much more transparent. I think what the book is prophesizing is that we need to put the brakes on some things and allow us to actually see and understand what the government's doing. And I don't know what kind of avenue, what kind of media that would be through, because it seems like most of the channels of media in America are also somewhat corrupt. When I first found out about the torture program, it took me almost 4 years before any news organization would pick it up and run with it, and that was truthout.org. Thank goodness for them.
Yeah, really. Well, this is a fascinating, nightmarish book. It's I recommend it. Broken, the authors are Michael Kearns, Ronald Solomon, the publisher is Rocky Mountain Press. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us and for the good work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Bert. Appreciate it.
Comes a time when you're drifting. Comes a time when you settle down. Comes a light, feelings lifting. Lift that baby right up off the ground. Oh, this old world keeps spinning round. It's a wonder tall trees ain't laying down. There comes a time you and I, we took our souls and we flew away. We were right, we were giving. That's how